Hi, family. I'm Irene. I'm an addict. Oh, I'm going to read it on the screen here. Okay. That makes it easier. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. You can read from your book if you'd like.
No, I think this is probably easier. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm honored to be reading this story about my dear friend, Randy, or by my dear friend. And bear with me, this is probably more talking than I've done in over a year. I'm not sure my voice will hold up. As a PhD student in pharmacology, his knowledge of drugs almost killed him. Now he is a professor with more than 20 years clean, make that more than 30 years clean, and an understanding that recovery is not a science, academic addict. The squawking voice on the police radio blared a description of me to the authorities. I ran into the freezing morning and began a zigzag trip to my apartment. I turned my jacket inside out so the color would be different. I was crawling through people's backyards in a Midwestern college town, an emaciated, drug-addled junior Rambo. I anxiously asked neighbors if they had seen any police around, my eyes bugging in panic, jacket inside out, sleepless for days. With their nervous assurance that they hadn't seen anyone, I went inside, threw away my stash, and crashed into a deep sleep, despite the looming raid. That I heard the police broadcast in a bathroom of a deserted university building at 4 a.m. on the day before Thanksgiving didn't cross my mind. The delusion of my imminent arrest felt absolutely real, and it fueled my panicked and pathetic reaction. I had been mainlining a relative of methamphetamine for 3 days without sleep, and the overdose had caused temporary psychosis. I found this particular drug in the pharmacology department where I was a PhD student. It was the latest substance obtained from my continuous foraging. My studies had become a hollow cover story. The search for drugs was my main activity. This went on around fellow students, staff, and professors who were growing increasingly concerned with my strange behavior and worsening appearance. As awareness grew that substances were walking out of laboratories, security measures kept improving. The foraging got harder and my standards got lower, while my appetite for drugs kept increasing. I wouldn't call chemically induced paranoid schizophrenia a quality high, but I was way past the point where using had the remotest connection to recreation. Drugs had become the center of my life. The night of the police raid is just one story from the bottom I experienced before I could seek help. The consequences of my using, getting evicted by a girlfriend who had finally given up, my gray complexion, my arms and legs covered with needle marks, the complete decay of my routine, the channeling of all my energy, resources, and creativity to find drugs, endangering the careers and reputations of my colleagues, made it clear even to me that I had a problem with drugs. Near the end, I admitted that death by an overdose would provide an out. That was where addiction had taken me. All I had was fear and the need to take drugs at any cost. My key delusion was that my problem only involved me, either I could solve it or no one could. Isolation paved the road to active addiction and it nearly killed me. My actions did finally bring about a solution, but not the one I imagined. In a bathroom stall, I injected one drug to counteract the effects of another. I collapsed, waking to find two freaked out custodians thinking I was dead. I was put in the hospital and kicked out of the PhD program with the warning that if I entered the building, the police would be called. My science career ended and my recovery began. Getting kicked out of graduate school was the best thing that ever happened to me. No, I didn't suddenly stop using. I wasn't done yet. But something had changed. That loss, together with all the others, made me admit that perhaps I couldn't manage my problem. I had a sense that maybe things could be different, but I still didn't know anything about living clean. That was for other people to show me. The disease of addiction cuts across all social and economic boundaries. When people have this illness, drugs will find them. The routes can vary enormously, but the destination is always the same. I didn't grow up in an abusive family. I lived in an affluent town and was educated in an excellent public school system. I had a comfortable home and a family that was loving, but perplexed by my self-destructive behavior. I had talent, health, opportunities, friends, and material support by any measure, but I am different from normal people. I am hardwired for addiction. I now see that some of my earliest thoughts and behaviors gave hints of what was to come. I found ways to get high, the usual things that people do in school, but for me, these experiences felt important. I vividly remember the first time I got drunk, the first time I used each of a long list of drugs. My using seemed controlled, but I got high every day of high school, and whatever drugs were around were part of the mix. In college, I regularly did outlandish, selfish, and dangerous things to get high. I loved being a student and learning, but the parallel life of constant using was always there. The addict inside me is incredibly resourceful at finding and using drugs. When it was time for graduate school, I really did find pharmacology fascinating, but that choice also made drugs accessible to someone with no street smarts. In the years that followed, a lethal process operated alongside my legitimate interests. Eventually, as goals got in the way of using, they fell by the wayside. The progression of my disease would be gauged by a series of bargains I made and broke with myself to manage my using. I'll never use during the week, fell to, I'll never use during the day, fell to, I'll never inject drugs, fell to, I'll never let this hurt my career, fell to, drugs becoming my career. My academic expertise about drugs was a dangerous hindrance to my recovery. I was convinced my knowledge of drugs would make them more manageable. I now realize that this is like a ballistics expert thinking he is bulletproof. My arrogance and delusion would be funny if they hadn't come so close to doing me in. My recovery started with the undeserved kindness of one of the many professors I had screwed over while using. In an act of pure generosity, he found a drug counselor who would not be fooled by my tendency to manipulate people with my education. In my first sessions with him, I looked terrible, sounded crazy, and thought I had it totally together. But somewhere in my deluded brain was the desire to change. That counselor was the first person I had ever met who called himself an addict and had figured out how to live without drugs. That was intriguing. I wanted to know more. He first earned my trust, and then after a few weeks, he sprang the trap. If you want to keep coming here, then you have to do something else. More tests, reading assignments, visits to medical doctors? No, if you want to keep coming to me, you also have to start going to meetings. Although I was skeptical and afraid, I decided I'd better go. A manipulative addict successfully manipulated by a recovering addict. I went in with my difference radar turned way up, finding all sorts of ways I was distinct from those people, not part of that crowd. I was arrogant and judgmental, looking at superficial differences instead of the underlying similarities. However, there was one difference that surprised me. I had figured the steps would be some sort of instruction set about not using. Step one, we don't take opiates. Step two, we don't inject anything. But when I heard the 12 steps read aloud, they didn't even mention drugs. Here was a room full of people who were keeping clean, using a set of ideas that had never crossed my mind. Since my ideas about keeping clean had failed miserably, I found hope in the fact that these people were doing something different and getting different results. Some people experience recovery like a lightning bolt, a sudden flash of understanding and clarity, an immediate lifting of the desire to use. The effect of the program on me was more like rain or wind, gradually eroding my false beliefs. It is a process that continues each day I stay clean. I gradually learned that I have an incurable lethal disease, that having it is not my fault. But that seeking recovery is my responsibility. I slowly came to understand that fellowship is toxic to addiction and that isolation is a prerequisite for relapse. I still need to be reminded that my best information about recovery is heard from others and not my own loud head. I still struggle with the truth that in recovery, good action often comes before full understanding. It makes the scientist in me bristle. Some days I learn something new and others I feel like I am making no progress at all. But so long as I stay clean, the slow pace of my recovery is not a problem. There's no end to the process, so there's no need to hurry. The life I have is the unlikely gift of recovery. I am a professor at a large university. My colleagues are incredibly bright, creative, and energetic. I am humbled to work with them and honored by their trust and respect. I have long-lasting friendships in and out of NA, a healthy relationship with my family, and the luxury of earning a living doing what I love and respect. I am truly blessed, and it all springs from living the NA way. That doesn't mean my life is perfect. I have problems, fears, frustrations, and a constant struggle with low self-esteem. But I can imagine where I would be had I not gotten clean. I recall a high school acquaintance named Mike. We had very similar paths. We both were interested in science, both ended up in pharmacology departments, both used heavily, both thought our knowledge would protect us. But Mike died from an overdose over 20 years ago. My life is a gift, no matter what the day's details involve, and I owe that to recovery. You can have anything you want so long as you're willing to pay for it. This is an NA chestnut we often hear in the rooms. For me, this is not only about what I might want, but also what I have already received. My sponsor told me that every day I have clean is a debt owed to NA, so I am willing to pay for the recovery I have today. The price of my continued growth and recovery is offering the same gift to others. When I didn't have the experience to know about this path, others, both addicts and non-addicts, helped me find the way. They were doing my higher powers work, and now it is my turn to do the same by participating in the recovery of others. When I think about things this way, it is clear to me why fellowship is the foundation of recovery. Even with over 20 years clean, I still have to fight the urge to distance myself from people at meetings by focusing on difference. I still have to fight the urge to distance myself from people at meetings by focusing on differences. But now I know this is just my disease showing its discomfort with NA. I always try to look for the similarities between me and my fellow addicts. That doesn't mean we are all the same. In NA, unity is not uniformity. And there is no better example of this than how different addicts can be. NA is a big house, a big enough house for every sort of person. We can speak any language, have any politics or ideas about our higher power, and come from any upbringing. In this diverse and growing group of people, there is someone for everyone as a sponsor, a confidant, or a trusting newcomer. It is our diversity that makes recovery possible for anyone. No addict ever needs to feel that they don't belong, whether they know the ivory tower or the guard tower.
Okay, well, with that, thank you so much for reading, Irene. But with that, I would like to introduce Randy, the academic addict.
My name's Randy. I'm an addict. And appropriate for my academic life, I'm actually teaching at what I call the Edumacation Station, which is a computer center I set up downstairs, because I've been teaching large university classes online for the last year. So I'm actually standing. So if I look a little kinetic, I'm sorry about that, but I think the standing will help. It's like a podium at the Older Fellowship. So anyway, first of all, thank you so much, Namaste, Irene, for reading that. Irene is a dear friend, one of my very dearest friends from recovery. I call her my sister from another mister, and we have known each other for, I think, the almost the entire time I've been in the NA Fellowship, which I guess is like 23, 24 years. So we go way back. And she actually edited this story because she has very good copy editing skills. In fact, she changed eminent to imminent, which was correct. That's just one example of many. And I'm really touched that you read the story. And I also want to say I'm super honored to be here. I loved the other speakers I've heard. And actually, Sasha touched on something that I thought was really cool. Is my sponsor, Dr. Bob McFarland, who's passed away. That's why I use his last name. Had a story in the book called I Was Unique. It's still there. And actually, he and I submitted stories at the same time. He re-edited his because his was in the earlier editions. And I tried this out and then he passed away. But one of the things about him that was amazing to me was he never, ever, ever told anyone he had a story in the book. In fact, I'll tell you a funny little anecdote is when I was long ago and I was just meeting people in this fellowship, read that story. I went to my friend's house. I just read a story that is so awesome. I think Bob is going to love it. It is so much like his path. I think he'll really relate to the story. My friends are, you idiot. That's his story. And I actually found out from other people who knew. And then, of course, being a sponsee, I was all hurt and crushed that he hadn't told me. But it's actually really a very powerful lesson in the way he walked. He was an incredibly humble person. He did this world service and helped translate the basic text in all these different languages. He was an amazing, amazing person. And that was just one facet of his. He actually ran the first NA meeting ever in China. So that's like a billion people. So probably, between 500 and, between 5 and 10 million people, addicts available first time. And he brought me this t-shirt with Chinese characters. We joked that it said, my sponsor ran the first NA meeting in China. And all I got was this t-shirt. That was the joke that that's what the shirt said. I have no idea what it did say, but anyway, so I love the theme that, and also want to thank Francis for inviting me to do this. And I like that he goes, Randy really likes to share. I'm an academic. What can I? He actually said, you can share really long. I wrote, I said, don't say that. That's a bad idea to tell a, you know what they say about PhD, it's piled high and deep. And there's a reason for that. Well, here's my cat. This is Carbon. Carbon, meet the addicts. It's an open meeting. So I'm going to put him down now. He's quite famous in the university world now because of all this teaching I've done. Anyway, so I love that this is called That Was Then and This Is Now, because I wrote this story of over, I guess, 15 years ago. And thank God I have stayed clean. So now I have 38 years clean. So it's like that was BC before crack. And so, I'm super lucky to have that. And one of the things I love about That Was Then and This Is Now is it underlies and highlights the fact that what we do is very dynamic. And one of the reasons I think people should work the steps often, and it's just my opinion, this isn't a rule, this is just a suggestion, is because we're dynamic and we change with time. And the steps are sufficiently open-ended that they address different aspects of our life as our life evolves in different ways. And so, so some of the things I wanted to mention were how things have changed and become refined for me in the past 14 years. I mean, the cool thing is you now know my story. Like, I can't do it any better than that, because I can't edit my speech as fast as I can, edit a document like that. So you know my story now. You know what I'm about. So I'll just tell you a few things. As number one, there's actually one line in there that if I had to edit again, I would remove it. It says, I said that sometimes I know that good action comes before good thinking, and that makes the scientist in me bristle. Well, the truth of the matter is, and this is a little sciencey stuff for you here because I'm a professor, is that now neuroscience agrees with NA. NA was way ahead of the curve, and there's actually a number of very top level human neuroscientists who agree that action begets thinking, and that usually the way we change our thinking is by acting differently. So that idea of fake it till you make it has deep neuroscientific confirmation now. So we were ahead of the curve of people. So I would remove that line. It does not make the scientist in me bristle. It makes a lot of sense. But that idea, and more importantly than all that sciencey hyperlink, is the important idea that the sort of secret sauce, the critical feature of what we do is that, and it's right in that wonderful Living Clean book, is we cannot think our way into new action, but we can act our way into new thinking. And this, to me, is the sort of drop of retsin for you older people to remember CERT. So this is the secret ingredient, the secret sauce of what we do, is that we act our way into new thinking. And it actually explains so much about what we do. I think it is maybe the deepest little nugget that we have is number one, if we have to act our way into new thinking, that means we cannot do it alone, because all we have is our own thinking. So this is why we need people to help us, because if we can't act our way, if we have to act our way into new thinking, we only have our old thoughts to do it. We will only act in our old ways. So, to me, getting suggestions and acquiring what to do from fellowship only makes sense from that deep neurological feature of the addict, is that we act our way into new thinking. And so it also explains what surrender is about. So surrender doesn't have to be, lying down and getting, having the enemy crush you and steal your food and your family and all that stuff. Surrender can be thought of more like the way you surrender an old document when you get a new one. When you get a new passport, you surrender your old passport. We have to surrender our loan thought ideas for the new ideas from other people. So it makes surrender a deeply reasonable idea, that we have to let go of our old ideas because that was where our old thinking and our old actions came from. So that is comforting, because people hate the surrender word, the S word. People just, you know, maybe because we're American and we like to fight our way out of the bar that we walked into. Or I don't know what it is, but surrender is a particularly problematic word in our world. And so I like the idea that we surrender our old ideas and open ourselves to new ones. It also explains why suggestion is so incredibly important, because if we don't know how to act because our old thinking designed old and bad actions, we need suggestions about new action. Now, you know, one of the things about suggestions is if we like them, we probably already thought of them. So a suggestion almost has to be have a little bit of a resistance and negativity to it, or we would have already thought of it. Rarely does someone suggest something to me where I'm like, yes, to like, okay, you say so. And especially for people who are new. So I just love all those ideas. When I read that line in The Journey Continues, which I have this friend who calls it The Drama Continues, I particularly like that. But when I read that line, it just bowled me over. I mean, one of the things I love is as we grow as a fellowship, our literature becomes more refined. I've heard people complain that there are too many books. Well, you know, for an academic like me, we have a closet in our new house called the micro library. It's just all books in one place, so it doesn't clutter up the house. And I love it in there. So I'm a book guy, I don't care. But to me, having six books, it does not overburden our fellowship. And I suppose you don't really need any but the basic text, but there's some wonderful ones available. And that, I love that we're getting better at doing this. You know, we're growing up as a fellowship. So let me say a couple other things. And so some of the things that have become refined in the, you know, in the time since 14, 15 years ago when I wrote that story is, and I was going on sabbatical, and I actually went to North Carolina and spent about 4 or 5 months there. And it was, NA was an awesome part of that trip. I drove across the country in January in a pickup truck. I figured I'd do it right. And I drove across the country. And the dilemma I had to solve was, how do you drive across the country without methamphetamine? That seemed like an impossible conundrum, you know, for me. And the truth was that I drove each day, and then each night I stayed at some city and went to an NA meeting. And it was the connection to the human community that I got from doing that. I went to meetings all over the place in Birmingham and Atlanta and just all these really interesting places in Louisiana. And it's just, you know, NA meetings are always different, like cuisine, but they always nourish you, you know, like they're always a little different. I remember I was in Birmingham. This was a very powerful experience. I stopped, I wanted to go to the museum of the Racial History Museum there. And I stopped and I found a meeting and I drove, and it got progressively sketchier neighborhood wise. And I thought, you know, I put my faith in NA. I said, I'm just going to go. If someone steals my car, I'll be able to get a ride from one of my fellow addicts back to the hotel and then solve the problem from there. I go to the meeting and it was really incredibly powerful. I was the only white guy there, which was no problem at all. People greeted me beautifully. And then this guy comes and goes, you know, welcome to Alabama, man. We don't have fires. We don't have earthquakes. You should stay here. It was just awesome. You know, this beautiful, you know, all of that other, all those outside differences fell away because we're all addicts. You know, our diversity is defined by the simple idea. When I go, my name is Randy and I'm an addict. The Randy part's unique. The addict part's in common. And you know, the more different names, the more different places we have, you know, the better we can find that common link. And that's very powerful to me. So I want to talk about some things that I have 20 to 30 minutes left. I'm good. So, but yeah, I don't know, man, because Francis said I could talk on and on. So I don't know, Joe K. I'm not sure about that. anyway, I will keep it. Fear not. Your meeting is safe from going until midnight. So, but I want to talk about three kinds of faith that I've figured out. Or, you know, this is just, I have a friend, the guy who got me clean, the guy I went to when I first got clean, he says the most dangerous thing an addict can say is, I have a theory. You know, and I totally get that, because, you know, it's sort of like, I can think, you know, it's sort of like analogous to the, I often say that the thing that scares me the most about when newcomers say, I've got this now, I've got it, that, because I don't get it, you know, like you do, and you have 3 months, that's amazing, you know, and so that makes me very, very nervous when we have a theory. So I will give you a rejoinder that this is just my current thinking about this, but I really think there's three kinds of faith in NA. And what I love about this is it really clearly defines why we are not a religion. So I have the luxury, and it is an incredible luxury, of knowing lots of people in my life who aren't addicts. And I work with my colleagues, and I've become very open about my addiction for reasons that I'll go into a little later, but not 30 minutes later, sooner than that. And I often am confronted. People say, I looked at those steps and it says, it looks like it's a religion. It's full of God. Just God's everywhere. And what's that all about? You guys are a religion, right? And I say, no, we're not. And here's why. This is the first issue of faith, is if you go to a church, and I'm not anti-church at all, I think whatever works. You know, I've heard this great description that NA is like a dogma park. Everyone brings their own dogma, you know, and they all run around and play together, and they can be completely different. I actually stole that from the older fellowship, but I really love it. It's a dogma park. And, you know, and you can even go without a dogma. You can just go watch the other dogmas, you know, and it's totally okay. It's all good. And the difference between that and a church is, if you go to a church, and the church is a totally legit way to seek higher power. In fact, I envy people who go and get a pre-cooked, prepackaged, microwavable higher power that they can just consume without, you know, doing all that heavy lifting of figuring out what your higher power is. But if you go to a church, they will say, here's what higher power is. And it's usually an incredibly refined, incredibly detailed description of that particular entity. And if you don't like it, that's okay. You leave and you go find another one. But what NA does is the opposite of that. We say, the one thing we can't do is tell you what your higher power is. In fact, it would be completely inappropriate for someone to say, here's your higher power. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone. I've heard some crazy shit in meetings, but I have never, ever heard anyone dictate to someone else what their higher power should be. So the deepest faith that NA, that we have in this, is NA has faith in every single addict to define and find their own higher power. And in fact, we're not allowed to tell you what your higher power is. You have to find your own. So that is a 180-degree mirror image of a religion. It is the opposite of a religion. In fact, we should spell it D-O-G instead of G-O-D, but that would create a whole set of problems. My cat is looking at me askance. I'm kidding. And so, but anyways, I think that is the deepest kind of faith. As NA says, you know, we know you've had your problems. You don't know much about this yet. You know, your life might be a mess, but we have faith that you can find a higher power to do business with. And in fact, we're not going to tell you what it is. You have to figure it out. That's the process. So I love that. Then there's two other kinds of faith I think are super valuable. I call them newcomer faith and ongoing faith. So the newcomer faith, and this is really, you know, there's the first issue of faith is that one is too many. Like, I spent many years testing the idea that maybe somewhere between one and some number was too many, like three or four, two or three, and that never, ever worked out. Even a half dose, a half is too many, maybe? No, it is, one is too many is a very deep digital distinction between what we do and what other people do. It says abstinence is the only way we can function. So that's an issue of faith. You know, I had plenty of proof that 1,000 is never enough, but I had to have faith that one is too many. But then after that, the kind of faith I'm talking about is newcomer faith, is when we come in here, I have never seen anyone enter the fellowship when their life was not complete chaos. You know, I have joked that there must be somebody who's tripped into NA with already having an awesome life, and they just want to tick it up another, have an uptick of awesomeness by, you know, learning this beautiful spiritual path. But I've never seen it. And the simple reason is that addicts require a shitload of convincing. Like, if, you know, you read my story, and I wasn't even in the street, and it was like, you know, I was the only person in my world who didn't realize for a while that something was terribly wrong. I mean, I kind of realized it, but I sort of tried to gloss it over. And, you know, we're all like that. We all are. You know, we come into the rooms desperately in need of a change. Our life, it's like 500 blobs of shit hitting 500 fans a day, every single day. It's 24 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week, double overtime work to create chaos. And so the first issue of faith is that things get better. And they really do. It is an, and there's no evidence. One would not think that stopping using would do that. You know, I didn't have that coupling mechanism. But for me, and everyone I've seen, their life just starts getting better. Chaos diminishes, order starts occurring, opportunities arise. It's just amazing. And that has to be an issue of faith. There's no evidence that people have that that's going to be the case. So that's the next issue of faith. And the cool thing is I love watching that happen. I can never tell a newcomer how their life is going to get better, but it always does. And it's always sets of, like Sasha was talking about, documenting miracles. And I joke that we're in the reproducible miracle business. Like, I'm a scientist, and you know, many of the miracles you hear in religions are highly irreproducible. Like, I have never heard of anyone seeing another burning bush, you know, or someone, you know, emerging from the lion's den. Those are great miracles, but they are single instances. What we do are reproducible miracles. We see them happen again and again and again. And, you know, so I love that idea. But the third issue of faith that I call ongoing faith is that things go from being bad to okay to great. And what the analogy I've made before is, if you get injured, and, you know, any of you are having medical problems, God bless, higher power bless, agnostic intention bless, whatever it is, you go to physical therapy. And physical therapy is really challenging because it gets us back to zero. You know, physical therapy takes you back to what was normal. And I think a lot of people enter NA thinking that the best they're ever going to do is get back to some state before they use and normal. But the bottom line is that it is our first introduction to self when we do the steps. And with that new deep understanding of self and a different way to live, there's no limit to what we can do. I mean, it is amazing. So we go way past the point of zero, usually in a couple of years, and you start seeing amazing shit happening to people. This is the ongoing faith. And as far as I can tell, and I'm a lucky soul, I'm an incredibly lucky person, but it just doesn't stop. It just keeps happening. You know, so those are the three issues of faith. And I want to talk a little about higher power, because one of the things I love about that first idea of faith, that NA has faith in each person to find their own higher power, is it's completely up to each of us. And one of the things I absolutely love about the sixth edition, and I see that the author is here, so this is awesome, is there's a story in the book called Atheists Recover Too. And that is an unbelievably important story. It's the only story I wish I had written instead, because what it did was, it was official NA document that says we accept atheism as a version of, as a path to higher power. That to me is so deep and so proud. I'll tell you a funny story. I know I only have 20 minutes left, but I'm aware. I'm a lecturer. I know how to do this, but I know what I'm doing. But I went to, this is crazy, I have a sponsor, he's another young academic, he's a real smart young guy, and he gave me a flyer for the older fellowship, and I saying AA does not endorse it, so I'm just going to, just like we say heroin, and we're not endorsing using heroin, it's like, just because you say something doesn't mean you're endorsing it. But he had a flyer for the third biannual Atheists and Agnostics AA convention. I thought, now that sounds very interesting to me. He said, well, you want to go? It's in Phoenix, Arizona. So I got marital permission to go to Phoenix, Arizona with this sponsee, and we got the plane tickets, and he actually screwed up his boarding pass. I thought millennials had that shit wired, but he screwed up his boarding pass. So I went alone, and it's in a little, like sort of a very low level community center with a bunch of whiteboards and about 100 people there. I thought it was gonna be like a big convention because they had a super slick poster. But it was an unbelievably interesting experience. You know, these are people who are in the older fellowship who are really wrestling with how liturgical the wording of that fellowship is. You know, they basically, to me, are on the same path. And they created, they took us 90% of the way, and then we built a better escape vehicle that focused, I think, on the right things. And I joke that AA is my parents, and I live in NA. And I visit my parents now and then, and I speak their language to be polite, but NA is my home. And I feel that what we did is that one way to look at it is that AA is the yolk and NA is the whole damn egg. And so, you know, we sort of expanded it to make it more general in a way that's, I think, refined by 30 or 40 years of thinking about it. And maybe there'll be something, you know, 20, 30 years from now that'll refine it even further. But the thing I loved about that is that that story, I went around telling people, you know, we actually have a story in the book that might impress you because, you know, we have it, it's official NA literature that word is not anathema, that's one path that is perfectly allowed as we enter the dogma park. And I love that. Some other things that have happened is when I first got here and Sasha actually mentioned this, that her, you know, the prayer every morning was please. And the prayer every evening was thank you. And I certainly did that because I felt a bit uncomfortable with prayer. I didn't know, but as I said, I was so suggestible and so beaten down that I would just do anything anyone said. So I prayed every day. I say please every morning, which I still do to this day. And I say thank you every night, which I still do to this day. And but I've realized that I have this wonderful sponsee. He's another fancy professor. He uses those 25-cent words. And he has 35 years clean. He's a philosophy professor. And I'll tell you something, a sponsee who's a philosophy professor is trouble because you cannot win an argument with a philosopher. It is physically impossible. They are basically ninjas in arguing. And so we have wonderful discussions. And he is I jokingly call him a devout atheist. he is unshakable in his faith that you know, his atheism is correct. And he always goes, what? I don't pray. What am I praying to? I don't know what I'm praying to. And, you know, philosopher. And I said, well, here's the thing, that praying is not about who you're praying to. It's just a ritualization of the idea of asking the universe for help. That's really what it's about. It is the ritualization of the need to ask outside of us for help and suggestion. And that's what, you know, it's about to me. So that has really opened up my ability to understand prayer as a ritualized way to request of the universe and whatever version that is for help and to be open to that. So I love that. Another thing that's really changed for me is meditation. So it's funny, I joke that the reason we read these steps every single time, and you've heard them 26,000 times, is because for the first 25,999 I heard, we sought through prayer and blah, 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 to seek conscious contact with God. I just never paid any attention to that M word. That has really changed in my life. And it's changed in the most bizarre and unlikely way is I knew that meditation would be useful. And I think there's many interpretations of that word. But for me, from with my loud mind and, you know, my ability to chase thoughts around and ride them like wild animals, this has been incredibly useful to me, is I actually discovered that these phone apps. So, you know, it's easily arguable that the cell phone is the greatest breaker of mindfulness on the planet. Like it is the greatest source of distraction and irrelevant, intense, urgent, and useless activity possible. You know, and when you go through the Apple apps will tell you how many hours a day you spend on your phone, and it's just a horrifying statistic, you know. But in the same manner, I was led to through a personal trainer. I'm a runner and I do core training and stuff. And this trainer said, you know, there's this really great app for meditation called 10% Happier. There's a bunch of these, you know, and they all basically teach you a secular version of mindfulness. You know, just like, you know, exercise is good for you no matter what your belief system is, meditation is good for you, your mind, no matter what your belief system is. So I started doing this and I now have been just doing 10, 20 minutes a day now, just every day. It's not a big deal. And it has drastically changed my life. And I can tell you how I know this. I have the evidence. Is my wife, I got married about 3 years ago. So I'm a newlywed looking for Medicare. That's a whole other NA success story and a wonderful one. But my wife will now go, did you meditate today? Like she will know when I have not, because I'm slightly and noticeably different, slightly but noticeably different. And one of the ways I look at it is, and this maybe is going a little bit afield, but I look upon it as the normal person, they ride each of their thoughts as though it were some kind of a rodeo animal. And meditation teaches you to examine your thoughts like you're at the zoo. Like you take a step back, notice what I'm doing, see, fancy, I'm taking a step back, is to take a step back and look at your thoughts more like you're visiting a zoo or looking at a pasture instead of running and riding each one off into the sunset. This doesn't always work. I often find myself on the bucking bronco of a bad thought or a resentment, but it's allowed me a third place to stand to think about that. So I love that too. I want to also talk a little bit about, and so I have about 20 minutes, 15 minutes left. How are we doing, Francis? Francis, how are we doing? What do we got?
Well, you're doing pretty good. Why don't you wrap it up in, 10
minutes. I'll do it. Okay. Boom. Bam. Okay. So another thing that's changed, that was then and this is now, is anonymity. So for me, you know, and I understand there's really two sides to the anonymity coin. At least this is, you know, my theory. I have a theory. So this is just my theory. And if you don't agree with it, that's totally okay. I would suggest that there's two sides to the anonymity coin, and they're both about credit and discredit. Okay. So one of the reasons anonymity is so valuable is because we don't want to get discredited for a disease that was not our fault. And I have certainly experienced just from listening to people's chatter, you know, that many people still will judge an addict as being morally deficient. And it even makes sense because one of the symptoms of active addiction is bad moral judgments. The reason we have a fourth step that has morals in it is because we do very immoral things as an outcome and a result of intense using, okay? But, you know, the problem is not that we're immoral people, is that we have an illness that makes us do immoral things when we're actively using. So it's very important to explore that. So that's one aspect of anonymity, is not getting discredited for that which, you know, is not our fault. But the other side of the anonymity coin is that we don't take credit for that which we do together. So the reason that we don't want someone going, "I am the face of NA," is because there is no one face of NA. We are a distributed guru. We together come up with wisdom that we could not do alone. There is a deep synergy to what we do that absolutely requires people to work together. One of the things we do in the San Diego Fellowship is we make a circle. Hopefully some decade from now we'll do this again, you know, thanks to mRNA technology. We make a big circle, and I've seen this with 3,000-4,000 people at a convention. We'll make a big circle and say, you know, let this circle represent what we can do together that we cannot do alone. And that to me is, I'm actually tearing up a little because it's such a powerful idea and it's such a deep idea. And my higher power really is the synergy of people doing together what they can't do alone, that the people together are greater than the sum of the parts. The fancy 25-cent word for that is synergy. And I believe it is sufficiently super to not need to be supernatural. You know, I'm a scientist. I understand how wild and crazy and amazing life is. I also know how little I know about anything. I jokingly call myself an ecstatic agnostic or an ecstatic agnatheist. You know, I'm just, I am full of awe by the world, but it is sufficiently super that I don't need a supernatural overlay on it. And so that's just my position. But where I'm going with this, the anonymity, is that I realized that that this is another way to view anonymity. And as things progress, I mean, I've been a professor now at this wonderful university for 25 years, and I have 14 PhDs who have graduated with me, and, you know, so I've unleashed them on the world. And you know, this has been an awesome gift and totally a gift of recovery. The reason I mentioned it in a context like this is it's due to NA that I've been able, and due to recovery that I've been able to do this. But I thought, you know, I'm actually pretty secure in my position here. Like, they truly, unless I do something heinous, they can't fire me, and I'm not a heinous doer. And so that's one thing. And also, if it is a disease, or let's say an epigenetic phenomena, or a wet-wired permanent state, or whatever you want to call it, if it's a permanent biological state, and I'm a biological and biomedical scientist, I have a responsibility to talk about it. Like, if people with type 2 diabetes could talk about that, I should have the same responsibility to talk about my syndrome and destigmatize it. And I will say that this is something that is very individual. Like, both sides to that anonymity coin are really useful. I'm not discounting this one because I'm focused on that one. That is a choice that each person makes, and I totally respect that. And like I say to newcomers, don't try this at home. You know, don't walk into your place and go, "I'm an addict." You know, like, that's not a great idea. I was very, very careful and very gradual in this process. But I decided I wanted to start being more open about it. And this is the last anecdote I'll tell you, is I decided I was going to do this. So I first did a sabbatical in a opiate research lab. You know, it was at the Gallo Institute. And yes, it's Gallo Wine had funded a very fancy research institute to try to crack addiction. And although that didn't work, there's some really great science there. And I spent about 3 or 4 months in that laboratory trying to understand dopamine and things like that. And I'll tell you, dopamine is very complicated. Let's leave it at that. But anyways, and at night I'd go to NA meetings. I felt like a spy, but I don't know who I was spying for. It's not really clear. But so there at the last week I was there, I gave what's called a group meeting, and I called it My Name is Randy. And I compared the NA literature to the pharmacological addiction literature. And there's some very interesting parallels. So that was step one. And I started just getting more open, and nothing bad happened. That was the key. Is that actually everyone in that lab called me up and said, I have a cousin, I have a friend, I have a loved one, I myself have a problem. Like, people wanted to talk to someone. I thought, that's interesting. So cut to about 5 years ago, I get a call from the university, and they say, oh, we want to give you this teaching award. I thought, that's really nice, you know, because I've discovered if you're willing to act silly, you can get teaching awards. That's really the secret sauce. So, you know, I teach these large classes, and the students are relieved that it's not hell. You know, it's just sort of purgatory in biochemistry terms. And so I got this teaching award, and they said, would you like to receive this award at graduation? I said, sure. They said, okay, come on Friday for a mic check. I said, a mic check? You go, yeah, we'd like you to give a little 4 or 5 minute speech. Now, Jeremy's going, Francis is going, there's no way you can give a 5 minute speech, but I can if I practice. And I said, really, 5 minute speech? How many people be? They said, oh, about 10,000. I said, Jesus. So I thought, well, what should I speak about? And I thought that this would be a perfect opportunity to out myself about my addiction. You know, I figured this would be the opportunity. This is the universe has bestowed this on me. So I wrote a speech called Unexpected Surprises, because no one, you know, we have expected surprises like a birthday present or something like that. But there are unexpected surprises like I'm an addict. No one ever like, oh, cool, this is right under the Christmas tree. I'm an addict. It's a very unexpected. I also talked about my growth into a runner, which was also an unexpected surprise because I was like completely non-athletic as a kid. But that's not here nor there. So I outed myself in this speech with 10,000 people. And the ultimate effect was absolutely nothing happened. And I got a few emails from people who were in the audience, but it gave me open license and carte blanche to be completely open about my addiction, because nothing bad happened. And the chancellor was actually sitting there. So I did the positive control, the chancellor plus control, and nothing bad happened. People in academia like a success story, and they like a phoenix story. And so what I've been doing now is I'm just totally open about it. I'll tell you one final little anecdote is I teach this wonderful class called the Biology and Medicine of Exercise. It's like about 400 pre-meds who take it, and we understand what like VO2 max is and all that cool stuff, you know. And I will say that a lot of endurance athletes are recovering addicts. I joke that we still love to get high, but we're willing to work for it. So I was talking to my class a couple, when we had a class, this has to come back, and I have 400 students there, and I said, well, I normally have office hours tomorrow, but I'm not going to be in office hours tomorrow, because tomorrow I turn 36 years clean and sober. I use the C and S word because normal people, that's how they refer to it. So I speak their language. I said, I turned 36 years clean and sober, and I always take that day off because it's a very special day. And the entire class burst into applause. Like I'm actually tearing up because it was so beautiful. Like, this is, you know, 300 or 400 of tomorrow's doctors who now think that's cool and applaud people getting in recovery. So to me, you know, there may be jobs I don't get or things I don't obtain because I'm an addict, and there are people who will take that other side of the coin and use it the wrong way. But I don't care. That is so weird that I've had grad students come to me privately who are addicts, who are worried, who need help. It's just, it's you going to that other side of the coin for me has been super helpful. And so the last thing I want to say is, although there was then and this is now, some things do not change. And the one thing that does not change is that, as we've always said, any addict can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. And the last thing I'll say that I don't think has changed is that people say NA is the last house on the block. And that is when we first come in with all those problems, that 500 blobs of shit hitting 500 fans. It is the last house on the block, but it's also the first house on the block. And we turn that corner, it is a house that leads to an entirely new street. And there's that street is infinite in length. So that is more than enough out of me. And again, I'm honored that you let me share here. And thank you very much.